If you have a Bible and are going to turn there this morning, we will be in John chapter 13. And if you need a Bible, there are Bibles there in the chairs, the pew or chair bottoms, pew racks. But the words will also be on the screen when that time comes. How many of you have ever been a part of a production of a play or a musical? Yeah, there are a few hands going up there. And I was a part of several when I was in junior high and high school. It's just one of those things that if I had the opportunity, I was involved. And then after I graduated from college about 20 years ago, it's hard to believe it was that long ago, but 20 years ago, I was a part of a crew for a musical that our church was doing at the time. And I forgot, I did one play after I graduated from, no, I was supposed to do one play. And it snowed. And you know it's bad when you live in South Dakota and they cancel something because of the snow. It wasn't anything like the snow that I've seen around here. So, but anyway, my days of acting really ended when I was in high school, after I made a short one-act play, extra short. And if you want to know, I'll tell you the story sometime, but not for this morning. But one of the things I still remember, I can remember looking at the manuscript forms of the plays. You would show up and you would get a copy of whatever the play was. And the first page or two, three pages of that manuscript had descriptions of the characters. The more important the character was to the overall story, the longer the information and the biographical information on the character was, you know, things like what their name is, what their job is. You might notice some relationships to other characters in the play. And whatever other information would be pertinent for somebody to be able to fill that role in the play. Later in the play, when a character is reintroduced to the story, to what is taking place, there were times when that would be noted. Something special would be said about that particular character, and especially when there was a change of scene or a change of the acts of the play, or the scenery, the backdrop changed. Something would be said about those characters that you needed to know for the play to flow, such as, you know, a servant at home might be a princess at a royal ball, or a nun might become a nanny. You know, those are important things. With John, we are at a point where John is bringing us to a change in the act and a new scene in his gospel account. And so he is going to do the same for us. Yeah. What has come, what we have looked at over the past few months, some have called the book of signs because of the seven signs that are present in the first half of the book of John. They look to the second half and they talk about it as the book of glory, looking forward to the resurrection of Jesus. Other people talk about it as his public ministry and his private ministry. But either way, however you want to refer to it, there is a change that is taking place, and John is going to reset the scene for the new act of the gospel that he is telling us. And so if you want to turn to John 13 while you're there, getting there, I just want to draw your attention to something, actually a couple of things. First is that this is a Passover meal that Jesus is celebrating with his disciples, and it is from this Passover meal that we get the Lord's Supper, we get communion, we get this meal that we have just celebrated together. And it's also, John is unique in telling us that Jesus washes his disciples' feet, and Peter becomes an important character, but we're going to jump over Peter's feet washing this morning and focus on the teaching. And so, if you're ready, now we're going to look at John chapter 13. We're going to begin with verse 1, and after verse 5, we're going to skip to verse 12. And John writes, he says, "It was just before the Passover feast. Jesus knew that the time had come for him to leave this world and to go to the Father. Having loved his own who were in the world, he now showed them the full extent of his love. The evening meal was being served, and the devil had already prompted Judas Iscariot, son of Simon, to betray Jesus. Jesus knew that the Father had put all things under his power, and that he had come from God, and that he was returning to God. So he got up from the meal, took off his outer clothing, and wrapped a towel around his waist. After that, he poured water into a basin and began to wash his disciples' feet, drying them with the towel that was around him." And now to verse 12. "When he had finished washing their feet, he put on his clothes and returned to his place. 'Do you understand what I've done for you?' he asked them. 'You call me teacher and Lord, and rightly so, for that is what I am. Now that I, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you also should wash one another's feet. I have sent you an example that you should do as I have done for you. I tell you the truth. No servant is greater than his master, nor is a messenger greater than the one who sent him. Now that you know these things, you will be blessed if you do them. I am not referring to all of you. I know those I have chosen. But this is to fulfill what the scripture says. He who shares my bread has lifted up his heel against me. I am telling you now before it happens, so that when it does happen, you will believe that I am he. I tell you the truth. Whoever accepts anyone that I have sent accepts me. And whoever accepts me accepts the one who sent me." And so John moves from the public ministry of Jesus to a private room with his disciples. And we get in on the intimate details of what is taking place. And John, just as if he was writing a script for a play, takes us into this room and begins by setting the cast that is present. And so we begin with the list of characters. The characters begin with Jesus, and Jesus is the main character. In fact, Jesus is the main character of all the Gospels, and that's why in John chapter 20, John says in verse 30 that he's writing the events of Jesus' life so that we can hear them and we can believe. And so he says that Jesus is there, and then he tells us some important facts about Jesus. One, he is coming from God, and he is going to return to God. And Jesus understands that he came from God and that he is returning to God. He also tells us that Jesus knows that he is the Lord and the teacher. And when he says Lord, sometimes you may think, well, sometimes when that is used, it's simply a nice way of greeting someone. We might say, "Good morning, sir," or, you know, "Mr. So-and-so," or "Doctor," and recognize somebody that way. But When John puts that on the lips of Jesus here, he's saying more than just simply, I'm somebody for you to respect. He's saying that he is God. That he is the king. He is their king, but he's also their teacher. And so he sets himself, Jesus sets himself in a place of authority, actually a double place of authority, because he is the king and he is the teacher of the disciples. And he also says that you will know that I am he. And we may not see it quite as clearly as it shows up in the Greek and probably would have sounded in either the Aramaic or the Hebrew that Jesus was probably speaking. But when John has Jesus say, I am he, or you will know that I am he, he's not just talking about you'll know that I am your Lord and your teacher, but he is saying you will know that I am God. Because he uses the personal name that God gave Moses. When Moses says, who am I to say sent me? And God says, you will tell them that I am sent you. And Jesus says, you will know that I am. And so we have Jesus as the first and the most important character. The second character that John points out that is present in this upper room is Judas. And Judas is important, and John wants us to know the importance of Judas, and he makes clear that Judas is the one who's going to betray Jesus. Now, when this is all taking place, the character seated around the table or at the table with Jesus do not know that Judas is the one who's going to betray Jesus. But Jesus knows. Jesus knows that Judas is going to betray him. And John later understands this. And so looking back, John sets the table and he puts Judas in the picture and he wants us to know. He wants us to know that this one who, well, earlier in John chapter 10, verse 10, John identifies Judas as a thief. And he says, you know, he was the treasurer for this marauding band of disciples, and, well, he used to pilfer from the common purse. He's a thief. And, well, excuse me, that's John chapter 12, verse 6. Wrong reference there. If you're writing things down, I apologize. I got ahead of myself. And that's Judas. And Judas is there at the table, one of the 12 disciples. Then we get the devil. And John refers to him as the devil here at this point. And, you know, we might call him Satan. We might call him the deceiver. We can call him a lot of things. John chooses to call him the devil. And John tells us specifically that he is here, and John doesn't often bring out the point that the devil is present. And so when John does, you know that it's important. In fact, when John names anybody in this gospel, there is a particular reason, and you need to pay attention, because he introduces a lot of people, and he just says that they're there without a name. But he says the devil is here, and you need to understand that the devil has been there all along. John tells about healings, and he doesn't talk about casting out demons, but he makes sure that you know that there is a spiritual battle that's taking place. But in this particular case, he brings the devil to the front, and he says the devil had this plan, and he got Judas convinced to play a part in the plan that he wanted to carry out. In John chapter 10, verse 10, he's called the thief, and so you see the cross from Judas to the devil. He's a thief. Judas is a thief, and the devil is the chief thief. Elsewhere, he's called the father of lies. He's called the enemy of God. And we know that he's always there behind the scenes working. Working to make things worse than not working right. He's always there keeping people in bondage. He's always there causing people to harm other people. He's always there destroying peace instead of bringing peace. Then John made sure that we understand that the other 11 disciples are present. It's not just Judas. Judas isn't alone in this. You've got the other 11 disciples. And he refers to them as students. They are students of the teacher. He also says that they are servants of the king. That's where we get the Lord and teacher. You have to have students to be a teacher, and you have to have servants to be a king or subjects. And John says that the other 11 disciples are just that. They are the students and the servants of Jesus. And he wants us to know that they are being sent by God. But he also says they are recipients of Christ and God. They have received the blessing of being at the feet of Jesus and learning from Jesus. They have been the recipients of God's love and God's presence among them. But what we know is that as the story unfolds, if you've read the account of John, you know that 9 of these simply disappeared. Today we might call it ghosting Jesus. When they need him, when he needs them the most, they just aren't there for him. 9 of the disciples are just going to vanish for a period of 3 days. But then there's also Peter. And Peter is named specifically again. He's one of the 12, but he's not one of the 9. He's named, and you know, Peter is the one with this unbridled intuition. He sees a lot of things and he understands a lot of things. But what is missing in Peter is that little internal voice that some people have that says, "Dude, don't say that." Or, "Are you sure that's how you want to say that? I'm not sure that's going to sound quite right. Maybe think about it for just a..." No, not Peter. Peter thinks something, and before he's done thinking the thought, he's saying what he's thinking. Do you have a friend like that? If not, I'll be your friend, okay? Some days I think mine is missing, and some days I know I never had it, so... But anyway, Peter is the one who Jesus will, in a little while, tell him, "Peter, you're going to deny me 3 times. Peter is going to have this opportunity to deny Jesus. Not once, not twice, but 3 times. But at this point, John simply lets us know that Peter has one of those moments when he tells Jesus the way things are going to be. And when Peter does that, it never works out well for Peter. Because Jesus looks at Peter once again and says, "Peter, you just don't get it. That's not what's going to happen." And then we have the beloved disciple. The beloved disciple is there. He's not named in the book of John. And most likely he is John the disciple, one of the 12. He's in the upper room, and he will follow Jesus from the upper room to the Garden of Gethsemane, to his trials, and finally to the cross. John stays. But as John is telling us the story, there's one more person that's present in the room, and that's you. Oh, you don't read your name in there. You don't even read the pronoun you, but you are there. And John puts you there because he wants you to think about what part you're going to play in the story. Now, I know, first of all, that you are not Jesus. You do not get to play Jesus. Because I know I am, and I know I am not, and so I know that you are not either. You are not God. I am not God, so we don't get to play Jesus. I'm pretty sure that none of us get to play the devil. He stars on his own in the story from Genesis chapter 3 through Revelation chapter 21. He plays his own part. You don't get to play that either. We could be Judas. We follow along and we're there, but when the time comes, we simply turn Jesus in. Now, hopefully that's not the part that you will say, yeah, that's me. I don't think Judas would have acknowledged it outright. Peter. Are you like Peter? Always wanting to tell God how things are supposed to be instead of saying, God, what's going to happen and what do you want me to do? Maybe you're the other nine. You're there to follow Jesus and you won't outright deny him. You won't turn him in. But you know, if things get difficult, if other opportunities arise, yeah, Jesus will be there tomorrow. I'll come back. If Jesus asks me to do something, yeah, if I'm busy, I'm busy. Maybe if I've got a little free time, I can give him a little. Or maybe you're like the beloved disciple. And I think we'd all like to say we're going to be the beloved disciple, that we're going to follow Jesus through thick and thin. No matter what comes, we're going to be right there following Jesus and living out the example for Jesus. And my hope is that we all could fulfill that place. But John forces us to ask the question, which one am I? Or maybe even, am I one of those in the upper room? Have I even come into the room? And so we have the table set. Everybody is there at the dinner. And now we move from that to what is taking place that John wants us to see and John wants us to hear and John wants us to know. We know who's in the room. We know what's going to happen now is what we move to. And it begins with the acts of service. And primarily this focuses on Jesus. On Jesus and what Jesus is going to do. And it begins when John says that he came from God, and that he knew what he came for, and he knows that he is going back to God. Jesus understands the purpose of his life. He knows that he came for a specific purpose. And I love Philippians chapter 2. Philippians chapter 2, verses like 5 through 11. Where Paul says that we should have the same attitude of Jesus. But he says that Jesus was in the form of God, but understood that he needed to come to be one of us. And he came and he lived among us and he became obedient to death, even death on a cross. And Jesus understands, as he's sitting at this meal with his disciples, that the hour has come for him to die. He knows what the next 24 hours will bring. And he knows that he came from God with the purpose of dying But he also knows that he will return to God to rule. He didn't just come to die. He came to die so that he could conquer death and be raised to life. Jesus knows this, and he wants his disciples to know this. That he understands, that he knows what's going to happen. And then he turns and he washes his disciples' feet. Now, this isn't just giving his feet, their feet, a bath because it's a nice thing to do. This is something that was pretty customary in their day because, well, they walked everywhere they went. If you were really well off, you may have a donkey. And if you were part of the military, you may ride a horse, but most of the time, you walked. And most of the people didn't wear shoes that were enclosed. They wore sandals made of leather. And they were open. And they would walk along the road and they would get dusty. And since there were a few people that rode horses and other animals just kind of wandered, the paths often got covered in horse and cow and sheep and donkey feces. And you would walk along and you would get the dust on your feet, and then you would get that mixed on your feet. And if it was raining, your feet would get muddy, and you would come into a place where you were going to have a meal. And you didn't want to make the mess of somebody's house. And so somebody would wash your feet. Generally, it was a servant of the lowest class of servants. And the lowest of the lowest class of servants. Occasionally, if you didn't have servants, you would make one of your children do it. And on an even more rare occasion, if you didn't also have kids, the woman of the house would do it. But very, 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 very rarely would a male of any standing wash somebody else's feet. And they come into the upper room and they don't get their feet washed, and they've actually sat down for the dinner. And it looks like it's not just they've sat down for the dinner, but they've eaten part of the dinner. And then in the middle of dinner, Jesus gets up and says, "Oh, we forgot something." You know what it is? We forgot. You know, it wasn't that they forgot to get the lamb for the Passover meal. You know, have you ever gotten to the table and remembered you forgot part of dinner? Okay, I'm the only one, but don't come to my house. You may not get the potatoes you were supposed to have. But Jesus got up to wash his disciples' feet. And this is where it becomes important that you know who's in the room. Because Jesus washes John's feet. That would have been easy. Jesus knew what was going to happen, and Jesus knew that John would follow him through all the trials and be at the cross. Yeah, it would be easy to wash John's feet. He's the good disciple. The other nine, the nine that just kind of ghost him, they wouldn't have been all that difficult. You know, you got a friend that comes and goes, and you just kind of get used to that. And it's part of the rhythm. Then there's Peter. Peter would have been a little more difficult. Knowing that Peter was going to not deny him in his hour of need would have made that difficult. And then there was Judas. Judas. I would have had problems washing Judas's feet. I don't know about you, but I would have, and I have to acknowledge that. I would have had problems that night washing Judas' feet. And in fact, I like what scholar and teacher D.A. Carson says. Speaking of Jesus, he says he knew not only that the time had come for him to leave this world, but that he had come from God. and that the Father had put all things under his power. With such power and status at his disposal, we might have expected him to defeat the devil in an immediate and flashy confrontation, to devastate Judas with an unstoppable blast of divine wrath. Instead, he washed his disciples' feet, including the feet of the betrayer. He washed Judas's feet. And then he begins to teach. He's washed his disciples' feet. They're sitting at the dinner and they're eating. And now Jesus decides he's going to teach them something while they keep eating. And he's going to equip them for service. He says, "I am sending you." Actually, he says, "the one who receives the one who I've sent." And, well, the 12 are there. And who else is Jesus going to send but the 12? And so Jesus is telling them that I am going to send you out. And over the next few moments of Jesus' life in the upper room, he's going to fill this in more and more for them. But he wants them to know that he is sending them out. He is equipping them for service. In fact, he says, "Now that you see what I have done, you do the same." In other words, learn the lesson of washing of the feet. And that means to serve one another. To serve one another. Because they're all in the room together and Jesus is washing their feet. And so we need to serve one another. But it's also that we should serve those that are greater than us. Because I'm sure each of the disciples, as Jesus came to wash his feet, was thinking something along the lines of Peter. Most of them just didn't say it. "Jesus, you shouldn't be washing my feet. We should be washing your feet. We should be lining up and we should all 12 wash your feet one at a time instead of you washing ours." But you see, we get that. We understand that the lesser serves the greater. And Jesus says, not only that, but you should serve those that are less than you. You should serve those that are lower than you. Again, D.A. Carson says this. He says, "The heart of Jesus' command is a humility and a helpfulness towards brothers and sisters in Christ. The point is painfully clear. No emissary has the right to think he is exempt from tasks cheerfully undertaken by the one who sent him. And no slave has the right to judge any menial task beneath him after his master has already performed it." So Jesus serves his disciples. He is the Lord and the teacher, and they are the students and the servants. And if he serves them, what does that mean for them? And then he turns to the encouragement. I'm not sure it would have sounded very encouraging in the moment as Jesus is informing him that he knows what's going to happen and that he knows that he's going to die and that he knows that all of that is taking place. But if you listen to the words John is telling us and Jesus is telling his disciples, don't worry. I know it's going to be difficult, but remember this, that I know what's going to happen. And if I know what's going to happen, it didn't catch him off guard. And he was in control the whole time. Sometimes we face those circumstances where life seems to be more than we can handle. But here's the reminder from what's happening in the book of John, that God is in control. And that God knows what's going to happen and it doesn't catch him off guard. Whatever is taking place in your life, God is in control. And God can use the circumstances that you are facing today for his good, because he's going to use the cross for his own. He also tells them that when they see these things happen, they will know that he is God, that he is the I Am. That's pretty impressive. That's pretty important to remember, that when we face life circumstances and we see the things happen that God says is going to happen, to remember that He is God and we are not. He's also wanting them to know that they're going to have the strength to do what is right, because He is relying upon the strength of God to do what's going to happen before Him. You go back to chapter 12, and he simply says that he knows that he's going to die, but he asks God for strength. And if Jesus needed to ask God for strength, I think that we need to be reminded that we need to work in the strength and the power of God. And I'm pretty sure that the disciples did not get this until after the betrayal, the death, the resurrection, the ascension, and the coming of the Holy Spirit. I'm pretty sure until those things happened, the disciples didn't look at the upper room and say, that's what Jesus is talking about. But after Jesus raises from the grave and the Holy Spirit comes, the pieces begin to fall into place and they say, it all makes sense. And when they started to face trials, they knew they could face them because Jesus was with them. Now, while I don't think most of us are called to wash people's feet, in Jesus' day it was culturally necessary. In our day, not so much. We have socks and shoes and indoor running water. And so I don't think it's necessary, and I don't think we need to go about washing one another's feet all the time. This is the same way I don't think that we still need to greet one another with a holy kiss the way that Paul told the church to. But I think we have to ask the question, what can I do to serve others for their benefit and not to make myself feel better? Not to make myself look better in other people's eyes, but how can I serve other people simply because they need served? Jesus suggests a cup of cold water or a visit when somebody's in need. James suggests a coat or a plate of food. Jesus doesn't give us license to ask whether we will respond or use our generosity, but only that we see a need and we submit to His authority. And if He, our Lord and Teacher, has done this much for us, how much more should we seek to serve others? And the greatest need of all is to tell them about Jesus' saving grace and passing on the warning of judgment. Let us go and serve as we have been served.